This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
We have some time now for some questions, so I'm sure you're bursting to ask our panel questions. If you would wait for the mic to come to you, we have roving mics, and please say who you are, not least of all for the benefit of our online viewers. Who has a question? Really? You're going to who needs nudging into asking a question? Let's make it easier for you, shall we?
Well, can we ask you a question? How about that then? How many of you are already using some of these approaches? Do you have examples where you're... Oh, look at that. Do you want to share a few of them? Some of you.
See, I want to ask you a question, actually, David, which is... they have a moment to think. Which is, at the moment, most of the emphasis on nudges, behavioural economics, appears to be about invoking change in individuals. And yet at a time when everybody is talking about the need for our institutions to change, to do things differently, not sort of just to do the same but less, how much effort should we be putting into the way that citizens and communities can nudge our institutions to change?
Well, I mean, I'd just have a quick go at that one. To me, it's absolutely a key part of it, and often the discussions that are happening are around... Well, how might services alter? How might professionals change their behaviour? I mean, some of the, particularly the big society type argument implies a very different kind of professional relationship, often, right? Because it means that, you know, the patient is more expert, or so on, and it requires a different role and part of the professional, which is often quite a challenging one. So, how do you create those kind of feedback loops? You can do it in sort of deliberately disruptive ways through some process of public service reform. I mean, other ways I think are really powerful. It's worth thinking about what are the effective ways. It's just very direct feedback, for example. I mean, when you talk a lot about the professionals and so on, but actually, of course, citizens matter too, and what's the pressure? Now, maybe you just take it as read, but I think it's enormous power. You create very short feedback loops. I mean, Canada actually partly transformed its public services by something called Citizen First, which essentially was an ongoing survey across various sectors about how did citizens feel about services. And, of course, you know, most public servants want to do right, but they may just literally not realise. They may not realise the impact they're having on someone. If you imagine you're a clinician and you're busy or whatever. I mean, you see variants on that already, including actually in staff, for example, in the health system, where people are now building incredibly fast feedback loops, much more sophisticated than the one which Canada used to drive up public satisfaction. Where, you know, literally an individual clinician will know, actually, this is how your patients felt and experienced what you were doing, you know. Now, that is a pretty powerful behavioural influence on changing, you know, what people are doing. So that's absolutely a parallel thread.
Yes.
Absolutely. But I think Tony, you know about the work of Liz Richardson in IPEG, and I think what Liz, as you're doing, is doing experiments of citizens on policymakers. By actually getting citizens to kind of nudge policymakers, write them letters, and those sorts of things. And I think one of the things that we found is that policymakers are not that responsive. We did a research project on creating local lobby groups to write to locally elected councillors with different kind of sort of nudges and information. And one of the things that really struck us was the actual low level of responses. From kind of legitimate local groups, just writing letters to their local councillors, let alone the idea that the councillors would actually would respond to well-tailored information.
18.5%, I have from memory, of councillors, regardless of whether they were nudged or not, actually responded to a letter from a constituent, which suggests to me that actually the nudges are much less significant than actually the capacity and the culture of our institutions in responding to that.
I suppose my build on this is never underestimate, I mean, obviously within the context of democratic accountability, but never underestimate the potential of staff to change institutions too. I mean, I think, looking back at it, a bit of my presentation was very, very top down. I mean, one of the things I perhaps didn't emphasise enough is actually, you know, if you empower staff to change themselves to develop and deliver change, in my view, it is far more effective than yet another series of, obviously, top-down approaches. Now, but as public sector organisations, we're very bad at doing that because the sense of being able to trust people who work for you, to actually have the knowledge, the commitment, but also the ability to develop and deliver change. But again, total place, the concept will not work if it is top down. It will only work if actually all those small detail bits on the ground, if the staff themselves are, we are absolutely awful at enabling people in the public sector too. I mean, the bureaucratic, I mean, that's another factor, it seems to me, that we need to take into account, that the bureaucratic and managerial restraints that we place on people in terms of their freedom of action, it's a very risk-averse environment for very good reasons. But let's notice that risk aversion doesn't actually prevent the risk, you know, kind of doesn't present the disaster happening necessarily.
And there was indeed an empowering the frontline task force that I think never actually reported from the last, it probably got squashed from the top. Right, come on, you must have some questions now. Yes, someone at the front, if you just say who you are once we have the microphone, that will be great. And if there's anyone else, we'll come to you, maybe take a few.
Paula Clayton-Smith from Keep Britain Tidy. Yeah. What's quite interesting is that we've done a whole load of sort of behaviour change research probably since the 1960s. And actually now is a really exciting time because we're finding that local authorities are starting to talk to us about the different types of behaviour change activity that can happen, whether that be through sort of nudge but what I was trying to say is that we're finding that there are local authorities who are actually using nudge in different sorts of ways, whether that be through sort of an enforcement type nudge, but actually through people enforcing through each other, as you say, but also through local authorities looking at handing over responsibilities to communities themselves. And one of our colleagues will be sort of speaking from Sutton Leighton to sort of talk about that in a bit more detail. But I think for us, it's, you know, we've been gagging at the sort of the bit almost to help people talk about behaviour change for years. So it's sort of, it feels like it's a time right for us. So sorry to be a bit enthusiastic, it isn't just about sort of beating people about the head. You know, we've found exactly the same, that if people are seeing people that aren't littering, that has the same sort of impacts. We've done the same sorts of research in, you know, deprived neighbourhoods and areas of wealth and the sorts of behaviours that happen there. So, you know, it's actually quite useful to sort of, you know, be able to hear that this is becoming more of a, you know, a government sort of process to action, really.
Thank you. Do we have any others? I mean, there was that very good example in China, was it, where the litter pickers or someone, which was very interesting how that tipped, reached a tipping point. Do we have any more? We've got it. Yes, sir.
Okay.
Could you stand up? Sorry, it'd be much easier for the people watching online to see.
My name's David Wolverson. I'm from the Dimensions, and we support people with learning disabilities and autism across England and Wales. And I think one of my issues is I think all this stuff is fantastic, but actually the grim reality between the policy and the thought to the experience of people, especially in the social care sector, is so significant. And I think there's a systemic issue here. Social care is basically whatever all the guff is founded on rationing. And therefore, whenever you talk to parents and people, it's about a battle to get services. And certainly personalisation has been around a long time. And it hasn't nudged many professionals who are very defensive about their role and their process-driven approaches to that rationing process. So it seems to me there's a... it's not just about engagement of staff. There has to be some engagement with the public. And where does the power lay in all this? It seems to me there's a fundamental issue that some local authorities may change bits of their behaviour, but fundamentally, does local authority readdress a complete power shift and change the systems to meet it? So it feels like this is a great thing, but it will probably disappear into the sands unless we have a systemic rearticulation of engagement of society and local authorities.
That's really interesting. Well, I'm going to... one more, if anyone would wish to, is your last chance to ask a question, and then I'll come to the panel. I think it's very interesting, the whole community organisers programme, which I've been kind of talking about recently as creative disruptors, and how you actually challenge the status quo, wherever that might reside, I think is very, very interesting as an intervention. Right. Speak now, forever hold your peace. Gone. Okay. Let's go around in the order we spoke. So some enthusiasm and also some sort of systemic issues. Peter.
Yeah, I mean, I think on the local point is actually very interesting because in some senses there's a real danger, I think, with the behaviour change initiative to see it as something which is, you've got large amounts of research evidence, it then gets synthesised and then gets pushed down. One of the things I think in IPEG we've been really keen to do is actually working with kind of local partners and actually kind of bubbling these things up kind of bottom up in a kind of collaborative kind of fashion. And it kind of makes you think that actually, in fact, we often find there's actually quite a lot of behaviour change knowledge. I think this is kind of what you're saying, isn't it? There's a lot of behaviour change knowledge out there from research, from practice, which actually has not really been used. So I think it's really about creating the kind of creative potential, which actually can, and it goes to your point, challenge some of these kind of organisational routines, which, you know, will keep kind of going over and will survive whatever particular kind of fashion is government flavour. And I think it's really creating innovation and, I mean, I'm interested in kind of social science experiments, but I'm also interested in kind of policy experiments, kind of what actually happens kind of on the ground. And I think, and then you get the kind of positive feedback effects whereby what the citizens do is related to what the local policymakers do, and it kind of, you create a kind of positive feedback loop. And I think that's kind of what we really need to find. And once you've got those things, it's a bit like the kind of shelling party. Once the party's in full swing, wow, everybody's going, and then the thing moves on. But it's kind of getting there. It is a big challenge, you're quite right.
I suppose I'm in no sense trying to counterpose or the importance between staff engagement and community engagement. I mean, ideally, the two absolutely not just run together but interact. But I think my point is this, that at the end of the day, you know, we are still going to have lots and lots of people employed in the public sector who are going to be doing things. You have a choice about whether, you know, they are working at full capacity in an engaged way and enthusiastic way, or whether they are demoralised and feel like victims. I mean, we have a choice, is my point here. And I think it's critically important that we make the right one. And my final message is, you have to be honest and start from where you are. I mean, I think this stuff is really, really important. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying. And it obviously underlies a lot of the work on engagement. But I think equally important is an honesty about, you know, in any given institution or organisation, you know, where really are we? And what are the, you know, what are the bills that we need to do to make a success?
Thank you. David?
Quite briefly, I mean, Litter, actually, as I mentioned, Chialdini's original work was on it. It's a fantastic series of studies. And, of course, they're a great example to illustrate what Peter's talking about. I think it's Southwark, isn't it, that did the thing with, you know, dressing up as cigarette butts. And one of my favourite there was, I don't know if you know this one, where they drive around in a white van and someone would jump out with a gold envelope with someone who's picked up a piece of litter.
Thank you.
And then, of course, after a little while, kids and teenagers, any time they see a white van driving down the street, they'd look for any piece of litter they could throw into the bin. Anyway, so, yes, we're always really on the lookout, actually. Do come forward with examples to my guys in cabinet office. The issue about the, you know, social care and so on and rationing, I mean, it is, there are lots of issues in here which are not just behaviour change, of course, as you know about mainstream reform, but I mean, individual budgets have been very striking. I think I'm right in saying they were originally proposed and introduced even before the 97 administration, and then they gradually came up to a few thousand and so on. I mean, it's been incredibly slow to see that change. I think there is absolutely enormous power, but it is premised, that's why it's challenging, I think, for a lot of public service professionals on a rather different way of doing things, right? And I mean, just recent examples illustrate this. Camden had this great scheme where they were using for mental health services, and the use themselves were providing a lot, essentially co-producing a lot of the services. Well, it ran very well 5 years, and recently it's not renewed. Well, because the lawyers became concerned. Well, what happens? You know, paranoid schizophrenic meets bipolar on a bad day, and it doesn't end well. Because it never happened, but it does tell you something about a way of doing things. I personally think there's enormous potential around being, you know, facilitating some of this, you know, mutual support like Elder Plan, as well as some empowering element. Again, just make it real. In social care, I think there's an area in Wales where they're consistently underspending the budgets. People are intrigued by that. Well, there's a gerontologist there who's working incredibly hard to keep people out of hospital, right, through empowering. It's not just about saving money. It's a better way of doing it. And I'll just leave you one last example, a personal one I sometimes give is, I have two boys. My youngest son had a tracheostomy, an artificial airway, for the first 4 years of his life. And you get to be pretty expert, actually, after a while. One in 20 kids die from just blockage from the tube. We're carrying around, you know, two pumps all the time and a occasionally he would, particularly if there was anybody around, he'd just stick his fingers and pull this thing out, and then, you know, you'd have to run around trying to stop him dying. Anyway, he doesn't have it anymore. He's very good. At the end of that, you know, we said to the myriad of consultants that we dealt with, you know, if it's another family and they want an evening off or a weekend off, we could look after a child with tracheostomy. We know how to do that, right? We were never asked, never been asked. We haven't generally built public services that do that. And so I think one of our ambitions, this is deeper than a narrow behaviour change thing, is that is it just we want a very efficient NHS or efficient educational service? Well, of course, we sort of want that, but there's another thing, which is about how we relate to each other and how we, you know, support, and you know, it's about its qualitative character, which is not a story only about narrow efficiency, but it's character too. Mm. And that's a pretty big prize to be had, and a difficult one we have to acknowledge in a fiscal circumstance, not least when you've got very silo-based services. Mm. And that's not just about what central government would do, but when a lot of other people, you know, can we make that vision a reality?
Thank you. It certainly reminds me of another one of the experiments around the placement of volunteers, where 67 or so people, I feel like I'm quoting back your research continuously, but 67 people said that they would like to volunteer, but only six or seven were actually ultimately placed. So our institutions need to be nudged as well. That's my bugbear, my big goal. Right, and if you would just join with me in thanking our panellists in this first session. Thank you.